just to note our service is being recorded. And to begin, our prelude is by our own choir, and it's going to be led by Dan Proud, accompanied by Carl Wacker. All of life is calling me. Good morning, everyone. I'm so glad that you could come out this morning on this beautiful autumn day. The leaves, yes, are beginning to turn finally. We've been waiting for that to happen. I'm Rev Ralph. I've been a member here at Prairie for more than 20 years. If this is your first time here or your 100th time, we are glad you're here. If you carry the weight of a weary world on your shoulders, or you entered and through the doors with a song in your heart and a skip in your step, we're glad you're here. If you are the loudest voice in the town square or the subtle hand behind the scenes, we're glad you're here. And if you sing like angels or mumble behind the hymnal, we're glad you're here. The community here is what it is because of your presence, your being here. So welcome, welcome into the space of love and support, justice, compassion, and fellowship. We're glad you're here. Our chalice lighting this morning is Sleeping in the Forest by Mary Oliver and read by Heidi Hughes.
I thought the earth remembered me. She took me back so tenderly, arranging her dark skirts, her pockets full of lichens and seeds. I slept as never before, a stone on the riverbed, nothing between me and the white fire of the stars but my thoughts, and they floated light as moths among the branches of the perfect trees. All night, I heard the small kingdoms breathing around me, the insects and the birds who do their work in the darkness. All night, I rose and fell as if in water, grappling with a luminous doom. By morning, I had vanished at least a dozen times into something better.
Thank you, Heidi. Our opening music is in the Gray Hymnal, number 54, Now Light Is Less, accompanied by Mary France. Please stand in body or spirit. It is now a time for our story for all ages. Our story today is The Dark by Lemony Snicket, illustrated by John Clausen and read by Carlene Tiksinski. Children can come up and gather around the storyteller.
I have a green light here.
Now, can you hear me? Okay. Got to have everything right, the green light, the mic, and all that. Have my company. So this book is called The Dark. Are any of you a little bit nervous when your house begins to get dark, or if you're outside and it's dark outside? Yeah, you can nod your head. Yeah, sometimes I get that way. Like if I go in the basement or something. Downstairs when the lights are off, it's very dark. Yeah, kind of like this. There he is. Flashlight helps, doesn't it? The Dark. This is written by Lemony Snicket and illustrated by John Klassen. Glad they wrote and illustrated this book. Laszlo was afraid of the dark. Can any one of you tell me what's happening here? The sun is setting, and then what happens? It gets dark, right? So he's getting nervous. The Dark lived in the same house as Laszlo, a big place with a creaky roof, smooth, cold windows, and several sets of stairs. Sometimes the Dark hid in the closet. Sometimes it sat behind the shower. But mostly it spent its time in the basement. All day long, the Dark would wait in a distant corner, far from the squeaks and rattles of the washing machine, pressed up against some old damp boxes and a chest of drawers that nobody ever opened. At night, of course, the Dark went out and spread itself against the windows and doors of Laszlo's house. But in the morning, the Dark would be back in the basement where it belonged. Laszlo would peek at the Dark every morning. "Hi," he would say. "Hi, Dark." Laszlo thought that if he visited the Dark in the Dark's room, maybe the Dark wouldn't come and visit him in his room. But one night, it did. "Laszlo," the Dark said in the dark. The voice of the Dark was as creaky as the roof of the house and as smooth and cold as the windows. And even though the Dark was right next to Laszlo, the voice seemed very far away. "What do you want?" asked Laszlo. "I want to show you something," said the Dark. "In here?" "No," said the Dark. "Here?" "No, no," said the Dark. "Downstairs." "Downstairs?" "Yes," said the Dark. "Are you getting scared?" In Laszlo's living room was the biggest window in the house. Laszlo looked out at all the dark outside him. Above him, the roof creaked, and he closed his eyes. Now the dark was all Laszlo could see. "No, no," said the Dark again. "Not there. Down here." In the basement?" asked Laszlo. "Yes," said the Dark. Laszlo had never dared to come to the Dark's room at night. "Come closer," said the Dark. Laszlo came closer. "Even closer," said the Dark. Now you might be afraid of the Dark, but the Dark is not afraid of you. That's why the Dark is always close by. The Dark peeks around the corner and waits behind the door. And you can see the Dark up in the sky almost every night, gazing down at you as you gaze up at the stars. Without a creaky roof, the rain would fall on your head, on your bed and your head. And without a smooth, cold window, you could never see outside. And without a set of stairs, you could never go into the basement where the Dark spends its time. Without a closet, you would have nowhere to put your shoes, and without a shower curtain, you would splash water all over the bathroom. And without the Dark, everything would be light, and you would never know if you needed a light bulb.
Bottom drawer, said the dark. What? Bottom drawer, said the dark. Open the bottom drawer. So here's the cupboard with little lights all in it. Thank you, said Laszlo. You're welcome, said the dark.
By the time Laszlo got back into bed, the dark was no longer in his room, except when he closed his eyes to go to sleep. There he is, snoozing away. The next morning, Laszlo visited the dark in the basement. Hi, he said. Hi, dark. The dark didn't answer, but the bottom drawer was still open, so it looked like something in the corner was smiling. Does it look like it's smiling? The dark kept on living with Laszlo, but it never bothered him again. That's the end. I hope you'll think of the dark in a new way. Let's get up and go.
Let us now embrace a moment of silent meditation. I'll ring the chime to begin and also at the ending of this time of silence. Our presenter today is Reverend Dr. Michael Schuller, no stranger to us here at Prairie. Michael has spoken here many times before. Michael holds a doctorate in philosophy in the field of humanities. He has served as senior minister at First Unitarian Society for 30 years, retired now. And during that time at First, the congregation grew to be the largest UU congregation in North America. Michael is the author of two books, Making the Good Life Last and Humanism, In Command or in Crisis, just published last year. Michael will be speaking this morning on don't light a candle and don't curse the darkness. We are just delighted and thankful to have Michael with us this morning.
Thank you, Ralph. Well, I have to start out by acknowledging the utter appropriateness of that intergenerational message. I just thought it was a perfect complement to what I'm going to share with you this morning, and it is good to be back. So we'll begin with a reading in anticipation of my own remarks. from Susanna Schauler, and this was from an essay that appeared in Harper's Magazine 2 years ago. She writes, "Our attachment to light is old and tenacious. Light is knowledge, vision, truth. And yet, even in the persistent dualistic understanding of light as good and dark as bad, there are certain gradients, certain complications. Light and dark appear in the ancient Greek Pythagorean table of opposites, for instance, but the associations between the two are not entirely intuitive. Light, in the Pythagorean sense of things, is aligned with the one, the good, but also odd, motionless, limited. Darkness, meanwhile, is unlimited. It also stands for motion, even, bad, and the many. Light, for all of its virtues, does not give us everything. It is square and finite and still and inconsistent. In the Greek pantheon, light derives from darkness, Nyx, the night, who couples with Erebus, the dark, to birth Hemera, the day, and Aether, the bright sky. Day is hitched to night, the hours to the sun and to the moon. And this is a common thread in many creation myths, dark first, light second. Sometimes the darkness takes the form of a watery void into which the world is birthed. At other times, we begin inside the dark of the cosmic egg, a seed, or the body of a god. For the Zuni people of the Southwest, the first humans on Earth were crowded into four dark subterranean worlds until they were led into the light by the children of the sun. In the Iroquois creation story, the first woman falls from a dark hole in the sky. Light is an intervention. Darkness is original, primordial, the backdrop against which creation is forged. Life is only appreciable by way of the absence that precedes it. So light is attractive, yet distorting. The dark, on the other hand, doesn't distract. It doesn't astonish. It waits, and it calls us back. We have to work harder to attend to darkness, but you may be richly rewarded for it. The lit world may be the one that we crave, but there are also things that we need from the dark. Well, we are now well past the equinox, and I suspect that more than a few of you are finding it a little difficult to adjust to these shorter days and the inevitable limitations that it places on the outdoor activities that we enjoy. For instance, I'm still a runner after 50 plus years of distance running, and I always have been a morning runner, and I usually try to get out by 6 o'clock, 6:30, and now I have to wear this light belt to be able to go out and avoid being run over by somebody. But then too, apart from that, there are some of us, and my wife is one of these, who suffer from seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. And in the absence of sunlight, she becomes morose and lethargic and irritable. She takes vitamin D supplements, and that does help. We haven't yet transitioned to sun lamps. And yet our house is lit with our LED bulbs from the greater part of the day, starting in October, then all the way to March. And yet even these compensatory measures are no substitute, I feel, for a leisurely stroll under the living and inviting rays of good old Sol. Now, these are physiological issues, but isn't it also true that we human beings harbor a long-standing and perhaps even antiquated prejudice against darkness, like that little boy in the story we heard earlier? We need only look at the first few lines of the book of Genesis for confirmation of that bias. And here we are told that before Yahweh brought light into being, the cosmos was what? It was without form and void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. But then, for reasons known only to God himself, light was created. And God stepped back from that accomplishment, and he said, "That's good." That's very good. And this was, of course, but the first in a succession of mighty acts culminating in the creation of this precocious creature fashioned in God's own image, human beings. Now, the interesting thing is, for those that take the Bible literally, the sequence of creation is somewhat perplexing. So creation begins with the appearance of light. Okay, but it is not until the fourth day that God gets around to creating the sun, the moon, and the stars, the putative source of all light as we know it. Moreover, plant life also makes its appearance before God places the life-bestowing sun in the heavens. What's that about? But more relevant to today's discussion is the fact that God declares light and all those celestial bodies to be good, while darkness associated with emptiness and chaos receives no positive mention whatsoever. But as the reading that I shared a few moments ago suggests, this disdain for darkness, characteristic of so much Western thinking, isn't universally shared. So here's an example. According to the Tupi Indian tribes of Brazil, in the beginning there was no night. There was only daylight. A single creature who lived inside a lake, a serpent, as it were, knew the secret of night, the only being that knew this secret. But for many years, she kept the knowledge strictly to herself. But then, the legend continues, there came a time when the serpent's daughter got married. But her husband refused to make love to her without the night. And so the bride sent three monkeys as messengers to her mother, asking, "Will you please give us the night?" Well, upon receiving the message, the serpent agreed. That'd be a good thing. So she placed the night inside a coconut and sealed it with beeswax. And then she handed that coconut to the three monkeys, telling them to bring the night to her daughter without breaking that seal. Well, we're all familiar with the Greek legend of Pandora. The monkeys, too, grew curious. And in the middle of their journey to the serpent's daughter, they decided to make a smoky fire and to melt the seal and to look what was inside. And to their surprise, as soon as the seal was broken, night flew out and spread all over the length and the breadth of the earth. Well, the serpent's daughter knew immediately what had happened. And she waited until the brightest star of night appeared in the sky, and then she created a bird to sing for the dawn, and another bird to sing for the dusk. And she also created many other birds to sing during the day to distinguish the day from the night. And by this service, by the serpent's daughter, day and night were separated. And now the husband was able to embrace his wife. But in order to remind the monkeys of what they had done, their mouths were painted black like the smoke that filled the air when they melted the seal and let night out too soon. Now, compelling arguments can be made for the virtues of a light-filled world. And for creatures as visually oriented as we humans, darkness is, of course, rather intimidating, just as it was for that little boy in the story. It is this opaque curtain behind which myriad terrors and dangers lurk. Shakespeare once described the night as a vast sin-concealing chaos. It's a judgment with which many of us would perhaps concur, particularly if you've ever found yourself out walking alone in a cloud-covered, moonless night, and you couldn't see hardly anything, couldn't hardly see your hand in front of your face. And then, too, anyone who has experienced a guided tour in the depths of a cave has probably shared my experience. A number of years ago, we were 400 feet below the surface, and a National Park Service ranger stationed at Carlsbad Caverns directed our company to a row of low benches. Anybody been to Carlsbad? Okay, you probably have shared this experience. And once we were all seated, the company of us on this low bunch of benches, she proceeded to turn off the few electric lights that were dimly illuminating the speleotherms that were hanging from the ceiling and projecting from the wall. And now we were enveloped in an absolute disorienting darkness that most of us would never experience this side of the womb. And in that setting, one might well feel just a little panicky, wondering if, for whatever reason, the lights didn't go back on. How do we find ourselves out of this cave? Well, of course, the guide had a flashlight, but that's beside the point. Now, for centuries, there were, of course, valid reasons to be wary of darkness. Predators, both animal and human, relied on the darkness to rob the unwary or to sate their hunger. And so is it any wonder that when gas mantles, 10 times brighter than oil lanterns, were installed on English streets in 1807, the Times of London declared, "There is nothing so important to the British realm since the advent of navigation." Prior to the 19th century, Arthur Crystal writes, "Moonless nights presented a darkness so complete that anyone bold enough to step out was to risk losing his footing, his purse, or his life. Carriages tumbled into ditches. Houses were broken into or set on fire. The town squares were filled with beggars, prostitutes, and crooks. In many cities, gangs roamed the streets. The night, as one observer described it, was a forbidding place, plagued by pestilent vapors, diabolical spirits, natural calamity, and human depravity." And so come dusk, Crystal writes, "Bells were rung, horns were blown, drums were beaten, city gates were shut, drawbridges were raised, and stragglers were forced to hurry home to light candles and tend to the hearth." No wonder an Italian proverb admonished, "He who goes out in the night is looking for a beating." Crystal reminds us that reasonably bright artificial lighting has been around for only a couple of centuries. It can scarcely be gainsaid that our ability to abolish the night has, with our increasingly refined technology, has in many ways proven redemptive. But now I would suggest that the balance has shifted. If, for much of human history, darkness was an enemy to be fought, the problem today is probably a surfeit of light. It seems almost unimaginable that with the ambient surface light from our towns and cities, the brilliant Milky Way can no longer be seen by 3/5 of the American population, can no longer be discerned in the heavens. And the northern lights, well, most of the time, last Friday night excluded, even if you go out onto Picnic Point, it's hard to make out those lights against the nighttime glare from the city. And aesthetics aside, light brings with it other disruptions, as Joshua Sokol observed in a recent issue of Scientific American. He writes that wasteful nighttime lighting dramatically disrupts animals, plants, and the ecological relationships that knit our world together. It's easy to imagine the planet's wealthier regions cranking out ever more wasted light powered by wasted carbon. We should also be aware that our own preference for a brightly lit world works a hardship on many of the creatures that share it with us. Light pollution is almost certainly hastening what Sokol calls the insect apocalypse. It confuses night pollinators that we depend on to fertilize many species of plants. It interferes with the growth of coral reefs. And as an article in yesterday's Wisconsin State Journal pointed out, it has proven deadly for hundreds of millions of birds that crash into illuminated windows on their annual migrations. And ironically, subjecting a victim to bright lights continuously is a commonly employed, highly effective means of torture. "We prefer Apollo's to Persephone's world," Madeleine L'Engle writes, denying the obvious fact that where there is only light and no shadow, there is no life. Joshua Sokol acknowledges that lighting technology can still play a very important role in keeping people safe, but that our use of it has become excessive and counterproductive. "The brightness standards," he says, "are driven by convention, not by science." And although some cities have adopted the recommendations of the International Dark Sky Association, which was founded in 1988, the general trend, he says, remains dismal. The fact is, our technologically enabled capitalist civilization never sleeps. Restful nights have gone the way of the Sabbath. Light is, however, a boon to commerce and to the acquiring of vast fortunes. Our strong bias in favor of light has also had an effect on our inner lives and our moral compass as well. We declare that someone who is cheerful has a sunny disposition. And when a person is dejected, we say that they are in a dark mood. Lighten up, we admonish the individual who takes life too seriously. An intelligent person is bright. And when he or she grasps a new concept, we say that they are illuminated. And when a person lacks understanding or insight, they are left in the dark. One could go on, but the point is clear. We tend to associate positive moods and mental states with light. It is, Houston Smith observes, the universal metaphor for consciousness. Of course, darkness is seldom as absolute as we find it in a deep cave. Most of the time, it lies somewhere along the spectrum from dimly gray to inky black. And truth be told, we do need the darkness, or at least semi-darkness, sometimes to behold something truly special, like the Northern Lights. Or in my particular case, a few years ago, my wife Trina and I were enjoying a relaxing interlude at a hot springs resort perched on the side of a mountain in Southern California's Sangre de Cristo Range. And this site where we were staying included an abandoned mine that was home to tens of thousands of Mexican bats, who, to the delight of us and the other patrons, these bats emerge in this dusky, minutes-long wave every evening just as the sun was setting. The environmentally sensitive managers of this resort had adopted strict measures to reduce light pollution from the facility, so throughout the night, artificial illumination was virtually non-existent. Now, since those unadorned guest cabins where we were staying lacked bathrooms, occupants had to feel their way along a path to the Commons building to find relief in those empty early morning hours. But to our surprise and to our delight, at 7,000 feet, far from the nearest town, and without the aid of a flashlight, the Milky Way shone so brightly that all of our surroundings were visible. The tall pines cast shadows, and there wasn't even a moon present, just the Milky Way and its brightness. But now there is another dimension to darkness that needs to be lifted up. When it comes to our perspective on our fellow human beings, our cultural aversion reveals some deep-seated prejudices. Why is it so difficult for white Americans, or even light-skinned Latinos and East Asians, why is it so difficult for them to transcend their bias against their swarthier brothers and sisters? And this despite incontrovertible evidence that in and of itself, skin tone plays no part in determining an individual's aptitude or abilities or virtuousness. Why is that? Well, part of the answer can be found, I think, in post-Enlightenment Euro-Americans' generalized depreciation of dark things. So for instance, and some of you are aware of this, slavery-supporting clergy in the American South declared Africans to be the descendants of Ham, that young man who, according to the book of Genesis, had inadvertently seen his father, Noah, drunk and naked, an unforgivable sin. And when the outraged father, Noah, realized what had happened, he promptly condemned Ham and all of his descendants to lives of slavery. Now, nothing in the biblical text suggests that Ham was any darker of skin than his brothers, and nothing linked him to Africa. And yet, opportunistic proponents of black slavery invented these powerful scriptural connections to justify their overlordship. And those images and those metaphors stuck. Not surprisingly, people who have been spared this cultural conditioning have a very different perspective. So when early European missionaries tried to convert the indigenous peoples of New Guinea to Christianity, they encountered some rather formidable resistance. Among the reasons for this was the illustrated catechism that the missionaries were using for instruction. It contained these vivid descriptions of both heaven and hell, and these villagers were very quick to note that the residents of hell all had dark skins and wielded pitchforks. Heaven, on the other hand, was populated by these grim, ghostly white people floating amidst the clouds. And so, to the missionaries' chagrin and surprise, their pupils expressed a clear preference for life in hell. We would be wise, I think, to integrate a bit of ancient Taoist wisdom into our thinking. And most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the curvilinear black and white yin and yang symbol commonly associated with this ancient Chinese philosophy. And the two hemispheres of the yin-yang don't merely abut, they gently embrace each other. And each hemisphere also displays at its center a small contrasting circle, black or white. A better representation of the interpenetration and the complementarity of opposites would be very, very hard to imagine. And so Houston Smith, the world religion scholar, says again that Taoism eschews all sharp dichotomies. Those who meditate upon this profound symbol will find that it affords better access to the world's secrets than any lengthy discourse, perhaps including this one. Taoism's treatment of this issue accurately reflects our everyday experience of the universe. If the world were to stop spinning on its axis, if one side faced the sun the entire year, life as we know it would quickly cease to exist. The dependable cycle of day and night, that's what makes our planet habitable. And similarly, great moments of human illumination are typically preceded by a long period of gestation in the dark regions of the unconscious. Mythology also helps us to appreciate that mature wisdom and understanding may only emerge after we have visited the underworld. At least that's what the works of Homer and Virgil and Dante would seem to suggest to us. And then too, going back to that time before artificial lighting allowed people to go about their lives with less trepidation, there was also a downside to this awesome development. According to Roger Escrick, author of a book entitled At Day's Close, the unilluminated hours between dusk and dawn also provided working people and slaves with some welcome respite. Large numbers of people came up for air when the sun went down. It afforded these people the privacy that they did not have during the day. They could no longer be overseen by their supervisors. Darkness made equals of poor and wealthy, servants and masters, women and men. So I'm not suggesting that life within a pitch black cave is preferable to the colorful world we have bathed in warm autumnal sunshine. It's only that our own health, society's health, the health of the world's multitudinous living systems would be so much better if we made more of an effort to avoid these false dichotomies. Let me conclude then with another poem by the late Mary Oliver. This one is entitled The Lamps. 8 o'clock, no later, you light the lamps. The big one by the large windows, the small one on your desk. And they are not to see by. It is still twilight out over the sand. The scrub oaks and the cranberries, even the smallest birds, have not settled to sleep yet out of reach of the prowling fox. No, you light the lamps because You are alone in your small house, and the wick's sputtering gold are like two visitors with good stories that they will slowly tell you in soft voices while the air outside turns quietly a grainy and luminous blue. You wish that would never change. But of course, the darkness keeps its appointment. Each evening, an inscrutable presence, it has the final word outside of every door. Blessed be and amen.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. It is now our custom to engage in a period of questions and discussion around this presentation. Let us rely upon the covenant of good relations as a guide to ensure all voices are welcomed and relationships are valued. So with the remaining few minutes that we have until five of, please come up and form a line on either side of the podium. Raise your hand if you can't come forward, and one of our helpers will give you a microphone. Introduce yourself with your name and pronouns is welcomed. If you are online, please raise a virtual hand, unmute once called on, and everyone will hear you via our sound system. Or you may type into the chat, and the Zoom helper will read your comment aloud.
Hi, Kent Wenger, he, him. I have lots of things that I was thinking about, but I'll kind of restrict myself to not too much. But this is sort of especially appropriate for me because I've been camping really a lot the last few weeks. And I guess I wouldn't say camping exactly forces you to match the natural light-dark cycle, but at least it kind of encourages that. But I was also just going to point out that, you know, as you talked about, technology has sort of reduced or eliminated darkness, but our society and our technology has also, for most people, reduced true daylight in that, you know, we spend most of our time indoors. And even the brightest artificial light isn't anywhere near as bright as the sun.
Can't hear you.
Oh, sorry, I'm standing too far from. I said that our technology has not only reduced or eliminated darkness, but it has reduced daylight since we're indoors and artificial light is not as bright as the sun. So we've kind of compressed both directions.
I'm Mary France, she, her. I was, when I saw this subject announced, I was delighted because I knew that Michael would have some very wise things to say, and I have not been disappointed. This is an excellent, excellent discussion of the virtues of darkness. My husband and I were great campers and spent a lot of time out in the wilderness with no artificial light except our gasoline lantern, which was very noisy, and we didn't use it any more than we had to. And it's true that the light of the night is beautiful. When we lived in Afghanistan for a couple of years, we occasionally were invited to go to a wedding out way out in the sticks. We were already living in the sticks, you might say, but maybe a mile away on a dark road. And when the party was over, we had to find our way home. It was very challenging, but we appreciate what light we have. And John always made it clear that the flashlight was a handicap, and he did not use it. It's better to be as adapted as possible.
Hi there, my name is Daniel Tokarczyk, and in relevance to what he was talking about just a little bit ago, in the late 1800s, before electric lights really made their way out of the cities, there was a period of time where almost everybody in the community would get up at 1 or 2 in the morning, and they would be awake, and they would have music, and they would sing and share with each other before the workday started. So that goes hand in hand with the respite that he had talked about.
It is now time for us to prepare to receive our offering. This quarter, we share our offering with Porch Lights Dwelling Intervention Grants and Sustenance Program, which provides eviction prevention counseling and financial assistance to households facing eviction. During our offertory, the leaf unfurling, performed by Dan with his guitar. Let us receive the offering. Thank you, Dan. Wonderful. Our closing words are by Reverend Jane Chepka. When all is quiet and we are small and the night is dark, may we hear the tender breathing of all who lie awake with us in fear, that together we may gather strength to live with love and kindness and confidence. Our closing music is hymn number 46 in the Gray Hymnal, Now the Day is Over, accompanied by Mary France. Please rise in body or spirit. next Sunday, our guest speaker, Sela Bar, will discuss what is happening in Gaza and what people can do to help. And today, after the service, there's a visitor orientation. If you're interested in learning more about Prairie, meet in the foyer by the welcoming table. Also, today, after the service, Prairie's parents group, P-U-U-P-S, Poops, is meeting. They have outgrown the downstairs kitchen, so that family pizza party will take place in this room right after the service. If you're able to, please stay a few minutes to help set up tables and chairs for that group. There are more announcements in your order of service and news of the week email. We have one last special announcement. Patty, did you want to make it?
Yeah.
I think the group's name is Pups.
I knew it was something like that.
Yeah. That, like little children, you know. Right. I just wanted to remind you that we have these bags out in the foyer. They're $5. UU the Vote. It's the Unitarian Universalist Initiative to get people out to vote. And you can carry these around while you're shopping and talk about Unitarian Universalism or voting, either one. And there's some little pamphlets right by there. Thank you.
Now, we have one special last announcement with Dan and Carlene. This is a song about our pledge drive coming up. It's called the Pledge Drive Song.
It's on the back, the words are on the back of your bulletin at the top there. I think you'll recognize the tune. Let's see. Every day I say, ha ha, what is the tune? Every day.
Thank you. At this time, we stop our recording.